This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might think that an author who titled his memoir A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius would be a pretty self-conscious writer. And you'd be right. Dave Eggers' new memoir opens with nearly 40 pages of satirical explanations, disclaimers, thoughts on the shortcomings of memoirs, and suggestions of how to read his book. In the New York Times Sunday Book Review, his memoir was described as going a surprisingly long way toward delivering on his self-satirizing, hyperbolic title. Eggers is also the co-founder of the late magazine Might and editor of the current one, McSweeney's. His new memoir is about raising his brother Toff, that's short for Christopher, after their parents died within a few weeks of each other. Eggers was 21 when they died, Toff was 8. I asked Dave Eggers how he felt about taking on the responsibility of raising his brother at a time when some college graduates take a brief break from major responsibilities.
I don't think that there were very few, if any, things that I didn't do that I wanted to do because of Toph. If anything, I had an infinitely better time and a more full sort of life with him because, you know, it was just, we're constantly entertaining each other, I guess, is the only way to put it. We get really stupid together. And I diddidn't really leave Toph much with babysitters or anybody because I was terrified that something horrific would happen to him, partly as punishment for my leaving. But again, there were very few things that, if any, that it prevented me from doing. I wouldn't have traded it for anything. I mean, not a chance.
You mentioned being afraid that something would happen to your brother, that he might even die if you left him in somebody else's hands.
Oh, sure.
I'm wondering if you think having two parents die within, you know, such a short time of each other made you feel that death was just kind of present and there. And I mean, you know, this isn't supposed to happen, that you lose two parents for different reasons at about the same time.
Right. I did get to a point, and I had a sort of a naturally, I grew up scared to death of just about everything. Couldn't watch horror movies, and I was scared of the Willy Wonka movie.
Wow.
the Oompa Men terrified me. I had nightmares for like a year about those guys. But you get to a point where nothing really is all that unexpected, and nothing really surprises you after a while. And in a strange way, I know that it sounds completely unbelievable and strange, but I started thinking like maybe we were, it seemed as logical as anything that we were marked, you know, one by one, and we'd be picked off in one way or the other.
Was there a lot of like paperwork you had to do in order to become the guardian or whatever your official role was with your brother?
The really funny thing is that there's none. And it's come up a lot of times. I don't have a certificate. I don't have an identification card or like a plaque or anything. Not even a badge, you know, and I thought that maybe we would get something. And again over the years, people have asked for something. And I guess, as far as I know, there isn't something that one can get, like a card from the government or something, but people always ask, you know, give me some proof that you're the guardian, or give me, and it's always the most random people, like somebody who, you know, we just want to sign up to for some test and they want identification. And oh, it happened recently. He and I went to Mexico, and the woman that I booked the flight with said that I was going to need identification, that I was his guardian, because there are very strict rules about transporting minors across the border. And I told her, and we got into a big argument over the phone, me and the airline woman. I don't know. It comes up a lot, and it's funny. But no, there's nothing at all. And I guess all these years, I could have faked the whole thing. I could have kidnapped him and stolen him from somebody else and pulled the whole thing off. Nobody would have known, I guess.
You know, when you started to take care of your brother, you were, you know, comparatively close in age. You were about 21. He was about 8.
Yeah.
And you write in your book, You know, his brain was my laboratory, my depository. Into it I can stuff the books I choose, the TV shows, the movies, my opinion about elected officials, historical events, neighbors, passersby. He's my 24-hour classroom, my captive audience, forced to ingest everything I deem worthwhile. How long did that last?
It's still going on.
Really?
He's not listening as much anymore, but, yeah, I mean, I think that's the role of any parent, you know. It's kind of fun. You have, they have no choice but to listen and digest everything you say until they know better, at least. You've got them until they're maybe 16 or, you know, maybe 14, and then they find out you're full of it, you know. But there was a time at the very beginning when I took that role very seriously, and we used to have a lot of educational talks, and I thought about homeschooling for a while. And
to teach him about rock bands?
Oh, no. Yeah, sure. Well, that's part of it, too. You know, we would sit at dinner, and I would read from the encyclopedia, you know. Mm-hmm. I was a real moron about it all. And but he was a very willing pupil and very earnest about it himself. And we thought we were doing some kind of reinventing of the familial situation. But, you know, I got over that after a little while. I mean, the really serious, home education stuff. But otherwise, it never ends. That's one of the great advantages of parenting is having somebody to blather to, and they're obligated to listen.
How did the parents of your brother's friends relate to you?
Some of them very normally, some of them strangely, you know. There were some people that were very, you know, some people just don't know what to say and they don't know how to deal with you. And there's some funny stuff. I mean, we had neighbors that would burst in. At one point, a neighbor burst into the house thinking that she was going to catch us all in some terrible situation. I don't know. I mean, she hadn't seen Topher a couple days in the neighborhood, and so she burst in, and me and my two brothers were there, just sitting there, and she was like, "What's going on? What's going on?" That's what she said twice without even knocking. I mean, it's a weird thing. I don't know if that anecdote makes any sense, but for the most part, they treated me like a peer, and I tried to will myself and tried to put myself in a position where they would treat me like a peer. I pretended like I knew a little bit more than I did, probably.
My guest is Dave Eggers. His new memoir is called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Eggers. His new memoir is called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. Your new book is a memoir about raising your younger brother after your parents died. And in the book, you have a long set of explanations and disclaimers and so on before the actual book begins. And you describe the memoir as a genre that's inherently vile and corrupt and wrong and evil and bad, but you'd like to remind everyone that we could all do worse as readers and as writers. What makes you suspicious of the memoir as a genre?
Well, I was putting those words into the mouth of somebody that was criticizing me early on for writing one, that's sort of the assumption of a certain slice of the literary community, that the more decent thing to do is to sort of sublimate your own experiences through fiction somehow, or to, the more expected and I guess socially acceptable way to do it is to change names instead of and write the same story in the third person and call it semi-autobiographical. So I object to that. I just think that if you're going to write your own story or something that's more or less your own story, you might as well just plow through and do it.
But you're so self-conscious, you know, in writing the memoir. It's like,
sure,
you know, you're talking now about facing it honestly, but you acknowledge to your readers that, you know, any writer writing a memoir is going to want to be kind of likable to the readers, and that you can kind of strike whatever tone you want to for whatever reason you want to. Was that a really difficult thing for you to figure out who should the narrator be? Who should I be in this memoir? Should I be likable or should I have moments where I really intentionally alienate the readers?
Yeah.
Should I be ironic or sincere?
Yeah, there was all that. And I think all that sort of ends up in the book. I would imagine that anybody writes about things in the first person would do the same thing. I was really loath to do that. I had never written anything like that before, a long first-person kind of thing, and I felt a terrible guilt about doing it for the same reasons why some people don't like memoirs. I've never read a memoir. I've read one memoir ever. I read Mary McCarthy's Memories of a Catholic Girlhood, and I read that while I was writing this book, and it was kind of a mistake to have done that during the writing, but I can't say that. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't know if I would read this book if I hadn't read it. It probably wouldn't have appealed to me at all. But I couldn't do anything about the urge to do it. I just sort of felt like I had to put this down and I had to go through this. And while I was writing it, to sort of fight that guilt about it and my own reservations about it, I tried to make it... It came out in sort of a kind of self-punishment that I threw into the book. I tried to make myself look as bad as possible, as often as possible, and to parody the person that I was and the people that we were back then and all that might and Gen X stuff is, I think, kind of viciously self-parodying. And that's one way to deal with it. I mean, I was hoping, I think that inevitably, you're going to end up with the nature of this story. It could have gotten really maudlin really quick, and it could have gotten very self-congratulatory very quickly. And I had to combat that all the time.
How does your younger brother Toph, who is in part the subject of your memoir, reacting to the kind of public telling of his story?
He literally doesn't know anything going on. He won't hear this, and he hasn't seen any articles at all, and that's the truth. He's studying abroad right now with like half of his class, and he's busy with school, and that's it. We don't talk about it, and... I mean, of course, he read the book and contributed to it, and we went over all of it and fixed things and did the dialogue together and everything. But he's too busy with school to care about this kind of stuff, and we don't really burden him with the knowledge of it. So that's the honest truth. I don't know when he gets back. It might be a little different, but. High school kids, you know, they've got their own thing happening there, and they don't really, they don't pay close attention to these things. It's hard to explain, but it's true.
You edit McSweeney's now. How would you describe McSweeney's?
Oh, I wouldn't. I never know how to describe it. It's a journal of things that we find and publish. It's the only true way to describe it. I know it sounds like I'm avoiding, but I don't have any. We really just sort of it's an attempt to publish things that might not be published elsewhere, and to give writers a chance to write at whatever length and in whatever context and with whatever subject matter they might want to do, and. To experiment with the whole form of the journal.
The current issue of McSweeney's is, it's in a box. There's, you know, a bunch of different articles. Each article is bound separately. Each article is like its own little book with its own cover. It's on kind of real quality paper with really nice illustrations on each cover. Everything about it seems really expensive, and yet, can't be too expensive. I mean, I don't imagine you have much of a budget.
Oh, it was expensive, by the way. Uh-huh. Oh no, it was expensive. We're deep in debt.
Uh-huh.
We were in Reykjavik where it's printed, and as we were there, they were telling us. Well, we didn't really know. We just kept on adding bells and whistles to the thing, and more color here and there, and a fold out here, and only when they were just about done with it did somebody call and tell me, called me late at night at this hotel that I was staying at, and to tell me how much we were spending. And it was like one of these joke numbers that you've never heard before, you know, uttered. And it just didn't seem real at all. And we don't, I mean, we still owe them quite a bit of money. And but most of, we printed 12,000 of them, and they, we charged $22 for this issue. And we had to rejigger the math when I was out there once we got the price quote. But, well, you know, we sell all of them. And so we'll make the money back and we'll be able to pay the bill. But we don't really think about the profit margin so much. I always make sure that we break even at some point.
When you were editing Might magazine, it seems like you were just really annoyed with a kind of with the kind of magazine that would almost like coronate the person of the moment. You know, the hot person of the day, the hot trend of the day, the hot writer of the moment.
Sure.
And, you know, the hot young writer of the moment. And suddenly you're the hot young writer of the moment. It must be a really kind of bizarre predicament to be in.
Yeah. No, it's really weird. It's weird because I actually expected to be crucified for this book. And so to have people like it and to... say nice things about it in print and reviews and things is kind of a shock. I am getting crucified here and there by people, and that's what I expected. But the rest of it, yeah, the hot thing, I don't know what to do about that. I guess you just have to wait till it goes away and wait till they find the next guy next month. And in the meantime, though, I will say that the success of the book, and when people talk about the book, they talk about McSweeney's. And when they talk about McSweeney's, oh, and the book, it helps sell these things, and that helps us, and that enables us to do more of the things we want to do. Because of the success of the book and, you know, foreign rights selling, that sort of thing, that's enabling McSweeney's to do all kinds of stuff that we want to do, and, you know, last week we announced that we're going to start publishing books, and by the summer we'll have 4 books out. And we're going to try to use the success of one thing to enable us to do some other quirkier things.
Dave Eggers, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dave Eggers' new memoir is called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. Coming up, a review of the new box set, The Complete Django Reinhardt and Quintet of the Hot Club of France. This is Fresh Air.